Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Fundamentals Podcast. I am your host, Harley. Joining me on today's episode for a deep dive into the world of stand-up comedy, it's Will Chich. Will and I got talking over Twitter, and he suggested this idea for a topic, and I jumped at the chance to have a conversation with him about it. There's so much that we get into in this conversation, including the preparation that goes into being a stand-up, the different styles of comedy, the controversies that come up, and really how it survived lockdown. There was a lot that I learned from Will in this episode, and I hope you guys do too. So with that said, let's get to it. This is Stand Up Comedy with Will Chich. Hello, Will, and welcome to the Fundamentals Podcast.
Hi there, thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. So, Will, I'm really excited to get into this one with you because you've brought a topic that I'm honestly surprised when I think about it that no one's brought up sooner. And I think it's so broad and there's so much we can get into, and that is stand-up comedy. So I just want to know, like, what was your introduction to stand-up?
Yeah, I suppose I come from quite a funny household, and I remember my father listening to quite a lot of stand-up recordings. And I think by proxy, I've ended up comedy's, it's something I enjoy. So I always was into all kinds of comedy, but stand-up I started picking up when I used to buy VHSs. And I vaguely remember Lee Evans being the first, which is not something like, but it's one of the first I remember really watching with my friends and over and over. And it's just grown from there. I've always been interested in stand-up comedy.
Yeah, I think that's probably quite common to a lot of people. You know, it's this, like you say, this thing of hearing about it and then you get a VHS or a DVD copy. And I mean, someone like Lee Evans is it makes sense because he's been around for a long time. You know, he's been doing what he's doing for a while.
Yeah, and I mean, he has been on a long time. And I think because he's quite a broad comedian, it's a lot of, as younger, the silly, the slapstick and the running around probably resonated more. But as I've got older, obviously, I've started, I really dived into like comedy itself and stand-up. And it's just something I enjoy. And I mean, but I think Lee Evans and that kind, there was a few around that time, which were passed around amongst friends, the DVDs or the, well, I'd say DVDs, it was VHSs and I'm that old. But yeah, the VHS is being passed around.
Yeah, I mean, again, I remember having a similar experience at school with I was around in school when Live at the Apollo was really kicking off, you know, and then that would be a similar thing of going to your mates and quoting all the your favorite bits and passing around DVDs or anything you could try and get your hands on.
Yeah, definitely. And then I think as with like I said, Lee Evans is the one I remember because I just remember that being a name we used to talk. But then. Of course, and then you pick up, you go to the stand-up section of VHSs and probably watch some things I shouldn't have watched or probably didn't even get at the time, but they were saying rude words. Do you know that kind of thing? I was like, And then, and then the quoting things in school, I remember a lot of people. Again, Lee Evans was the one I remember at that time. There was a few more as I've got older that, I remember watching Frank Skinner was one of the first ones I remember watching, which was a grown-up stand-up.
Okay,
And I mean, still now to this day, I think Frank Skinner is one of the best comedians we've produced. I mean, probably shouldn't have been watching when I was, because I think if Frank Skinner is one of those that people forget that he is quite rude. An adult comedian, but because he's on Room 101 and things now, that people, I think people forget that. But yeah, Frank Skinner's probably the grown-up one I remember watching.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Yeah, like you said, there's that kind of transitional bit, and I think it's funny that usually comes in at adolescence, because that is a part of your life where you're kind of starting to pick up on those things in the real world in terms of people's conversations and attitudes and things like that. And so, stand-up comedy is one of those, particularly in this country, because we have a lot of observational stand-up. So, you're right. You can see how you can quite easily, you start to pick up on one or two and you bump into a few, like you say, more mature
comics,
and suddenly you're like, oh, okay, and you start to sort of understand, like you say, I guess, yeah, more adult humor and jokes and all sorts, really.
Yeah, and it does form, like, especially now, like, I watch a lot of stand-up, and through lockdown, I was watching, there's a I'll Always Be Comedy is called, and they do a lot of online shows.
Right.
And I think, yeah, it can form your, so if you watch a lot of stand-up, it can form your, like, ideas regarding politics and things. Like,
sure.
They would, especially back in the day, like Stuart Lee, who is something I've grown to more, like, even more now. Okay. He's obviously very left. And yeah, that would have definitely formed part of my political beliefs. And I'm sure other comedians have done that for other people, whether that's right or wrong. But that is. So yeah, I mean, watching those things in adolescence and listening to them a lot and having the CDs and things definitely formed part of my beliefs.
Yeah, because it's natural, isn't it? You get, you know, your worldview is shaped by many different things. And it's something that I thought we were going to talk about with stand-up. And it feels like we're broaching on the subject of, especially in observational comedy, you kind of start to realize that these guys are thinkers. You know, the reason why they're up there and what they're doing, it's fascinating, isn't it? I always think you've name-dropped one of my favorites. I think Stuart Lee is a really good example of somebody who is really good at making you think. And there's a lot of these guys that it's not just a case of getting up and riffing a few, you know, one-liners or jokes. It's more like they've thought about the world and about what they see around them.
Oh, and absolutely.
They want you to think about it as well.
Yeah, and even observational comedy, like your, which kind of, there's some of it, like, popular, like Michael McIntyre things.
Not generally
my cup of tea, but it is a craft. They don't just get this. They don't just get up there and do this by accident. I mean, I think that's one of the things that people do forget about. Certain, like, not all stand up is for everyone. Like,
no,
but it is a craft, and they've honed those ideas. They haven't just got up there and just said some stuff and happens to be funny. It's workshopped. It is an art.
Absolutely. That's something I didn't appreciate, I don't think, until a few years later. And you could start to see a bit more like behind the scenes of things. You know, I remember watching, I think it's probably something on BBC about a couple of stand-ups, and they were sort of following them around for their routines and like showing you how much work goes into it. You know, they'll spend a lot of time writing the jokes, and then they'll spend a lot more time testing them out on audiences and in, you know, small little rooms. And like you say, just crafting it, and like what you end up seeing on telly is really just the finished product, isn't it? It's something that they spent a long time, like you say, honing in.
Yeah, it's like there's a story of Richard Pryor, who's always regarded as one of, like, the greatest comedians ever.
Right.
But very few people saw Richard Pryor bomb, even when he was doing his the clubs. He went through a period of doing 10-minute sets, and he was essentially bombing, because what he was actually doing was testing bits, and that set came together as Live at the Sunset Strip, which is probably one of the most highly regarded sets in comedy. So it's that kind of thing where I remember comparing it to, like, it was like he was writing a symphony. So he was trying all the notes and then getting it all together, and I think that's something that is maybe not appreciated as much with when you see Live at the Apollo. Of course, it's brilliant, but that half hour set is finely tuned. You know, it's taken months, maybe years to get that right.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's other stuff as well, isn't it? I guess it's not just the material itself, what they're writing, it's also the delivery. And this is something that endlessly fascinates me, is watching different comedians and their different styles, right? Because there's so much variety out there.
Oh, 100%. Like, the same joke in the hands of one comedian delivered by a different one is a totally different joke and may not be funny. Like, yeah, I mean, you can... I think that's one of the, like, there's Michael McIntyre, for instance, or Peter Kay, who are observational comedians, and they may not be necessarily my cup of tea, but I think it's looked down upon a bit by your certain comedy fans because he's just doing, but they are doing something funny.
Oh, they're great. And do you know what? It's right. You're absolutely right. And it's a funny thing. The idea of snobbery and fandom comes up a lot in this podcast.
Yeah.
I often think, especially when it comes to something like comedy, because I agree, like, I'm somebody who I think Michael McIntyre, Peter Kay are really good at what they do. And I agree with you. Like, it's one of those I can watch a little bit and go, yeah, it's pretty good. And after a while, I'll think, yes, okay, I've had my fill. But I wouldn't dare dream of saying, like, oh, that's not very good. I could do that. Not in a million years, you know. And I'm sure anyone who says that, who thinks that way, if you said to them, all right, here you go, here's a mic up you get, they would just, you know, they would just run.
It's the old thing of, like, just the funny bloke in the pub, for instance, someone will say, oh, you should be a stand-up, mate.
Yeah.
Probably not. Just because your friends are finding you funny in that moment, an arena of 40,000 people are probably not. And, like, to get to that stage where those people who are doing arenas now, even your Frankie Boyles and people who, they are doing huge crowds, but they've had to hone that in small clubs where sometimes you don't even know you're going to see Frankie Boyle, for instance. And that would be a bit of a shock to the system.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes so much sense, though. Sorry, go on.
I used to go to the Glee Club a lot in Cardiff, and I've seen that kind of thing where open mic nights and or preview shows, and sometimes you're going to see any four comedians. So you're not... With the big arenas, like, if you're paying to see Ricky Gervais, Michael McIntyre, Mickey Flanagan, you've paid up to £80 to see them, so you're probably going to laugh, because that's who you're going to see. But those comedy clubs with 100 seats or 50 seats, and then Frankie Boyle or someone along those lines, who may not necessarily be your vibe, starts telling his jokes. You know, it can go either way. And so a lot of them plow quite a lot of, probably, you know, it would be easy to quit, I would imagine.
Yeah, I'd encourage anyone, I think, to listen to comedians talking in podcasts about it, because it is quite interesting when you hear a lot of the behind the scenes. And someone who immediately springs to my mind... Well, there's two of them, Ed Gamble and James Acaster, who are both really good at what they do. The off-menu show is great. Like, I've mentioned it before, people should go and listen. But they'll tell stories about being on stage in, like, times where things have got dicey or they bombed. You know, and it's interesting when you hear them talk about it, because, like you say, we watch the final products on the telly or on, like, a panel show, and we go, oh, but they're brilliant. They must be brilliant all the time. It must be everybody finds them hilarious.
Yeah.
And then you find out, like you said, no, a lot of the time sometimes they just get in a car and they just drive into all these little venues and they spend 6 months just slogging it out, and it can be hit or miss. And I got to say, my respect goes up for them when I hear that.
Oh, 100%. I mean, go into a room at maybe 1 a.m. where...
Yeah.
And these people... they are going, right, I paid my £5 on the door, make me laugh. And 10 pints deep, make me laugh. That can't be, a daunting prospect for anyone, especially if you don't know who your crowd is. Like, I've heard a lot of comedians say there's nothing worse than when someone will say, well, I've got a stag do booked in. Like, oh, no.
Yeah, I can imagine, yeah. Yeah, you get all the heckling and all the rowdy lot. You just for goodness sake.
I mean, that's another thing. Like, you have to be on your game. I'm not a stand-up, but I've seen stand-up. But heckling, that kind of stuff. You hear stories of heckling, which there would be the end of me. I mean, no, thank you, I'm done. Yeah. But you have to,
You have to know how to respond. I totally agree. And I got a bit. I don't know about you. I've only ever been to a couple of comedy shows, but whenever I have, I just don't get why people would heckle. I'm just looking at that person thinking, like, especially when you're seeing them in, like, I've seen them in theatres and venues, like you say, where they've built up to that. And so I'm just thinking, like, it's the physical equivalent of going up to someone who's, you know, a professional boxer for a living,
trying to throw a right hook and expecting to land it. You're like, no, you're just going to get lamped in front of everyone.
Exactly, yeah. I get with panel shows, and I mean, I do think sometimes some, like the famous, like Preston walking off, never mind the Buzzcocks and that, you are a bit of a lamb.
Yeah.
You are a bit of a lamb to the slaughter. But these people, or there was, again, never mind the Buzzcocks, Donny Tourette going on there and trying to outwit Bill Bailey. And you just think, it's
not going to happen.
Job. No, it is literally his job. I like the heckling thing. I think sometimes, I mean, I've seen at comedy gigs where the heckling is kind of, if it's lighthearted heckling, which brings something to the show, I think it's different. Like Nick Helm is almost invited sometimes. I've been to shows with Nick Helm, and he kind of like that audience thing is part of his thing.
Right.
And also, I've been to shows where the comedian, John Robbins, for instance, he does a half hour before when he literally says, right, if you're going to heckle, let's do it now. Because as soon as I start the show, it's a performance. You heckled, you leave. That kind of thing, which I understand because...
Okay.
The other thing that I think people look with stand-up especially is, it is a performance. You build into something. So those heckles sometimes will break the flow of...
Sure.
Well, it's essentially a piece of theatre, a performance.
Right, yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, if you were at a show, like a theatre show, and you started... Unless it's a pantomime, of course. You know, if you just started shouting at them, I'm sure they'd be like, what are you doing? Like, stop
it. If you started giving Macbeth a bit, I'm sure you'd be kicked out. So, I think that's... stand-ups, I think, if you don't like stand-up, for instance, or not really into stand-up, it can be seen as it's just a guy or a woman just doing jokes, just one-liners. Right. But Hannah Gadsby, who that's on Netflix, and it's an amazing show, but it is a performance piece.
Right.
It's as close to, I suppose, the crossover between like theatre monologue and stand-up that is very funny, but there's an absolute message in it, and it is a performance piece. I think there is some real challenging stand-up about, which absolutely not for everyone, but I quite enjoy I enjoy the challenge of it and enjoy being a bit challenged by things. I think that's a bit of part of stand-up that gets forgotten as well.
Do you know, that's a really good point, actually. I was thinking about it today, like, I feel like when it comes to the challenging stuff, that's often the stuff that gets misunderstood, right? Or gets misquoted and taken out of context sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a big difference between the out of context thing is a big issue, I think, with absolutely not for everyone. Say, for instance, Frankie Boyle, again.
Sure.
Is just an example of someone who really does push it to the limit with what he says. Yeah. I think and Jimmy Carr's fallen foul of it at the moment with a joke that's been about.
I think I've heard about that.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, we won't repeat the jokes. It's terrible. It's a bad taste, very bad taste joke.
Sure,
but I think the difference is the content is different to the intent. So I think the intent sometimes is what's missed. So if you're making a joke about a subject, I think it's you should be allowed to. But if the intent is to be hateful to that subject, then that's a totally different thing.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, definitely the intent makes a huge difference, right? Because, that's often the way. And to be fair as well, like you said, those kind of comedians, especially ones I think that make a living out of being, I guess, edgy, for lack of a better word, you kind of expect it. And I do think there's a little bit of an onus on you as an audience. And if you can say, like you said, I mean, there's like guys like Frankie Boyle, for me, not for me. But because of that, I'm not going to go looking for jokes to get offended about or get angry about. And if I hear about it, I'll just go, well, that's his thing. And I think the more that you do it, and the more that people kick up a fuss, it's like you do realize you're drawing more attention to that. And if you're trying to make a point, you're just going to make it worse.
So the Frankie Boyle is one because he's constantly under fire for jokes he's made. But he made a joke which came under fire. And but those jokes were in a sellout show called I Would Happily Come Down There and Punch Each One of You in the Face, was the name of his stand-up show. Yeah. If you're going to that and then going, well, that was offensive, you've missed. You shouldn't have gone to that show. It's not for you. You know, so I understand, and I think, again, it's intent. Some things probably, it's not my cup of tea to joke about them. But that doesn't say they shouldn't be joked about if the intention is right.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of comedians talk about this, you know, and I guess you do get people that will say, oh, you can't make a joke about anything these days. And yeah, I think a lot of them have made your point on observation, which is like, no, it's a lot of it's in the delivery. And what are you trying to say about that subject? You know, and are you punching up or punching down, or are you making a point, as you said earlier? You know, are you trying to say something bigger and make an audience feel uncomfortable to make them think about it? Or are you just going after a sensitive topic just for a cheap joke and a bit of shock value?
Yeah, I mean, there are comedians who are guilty of it. And I will watch. I just like stand-up in general, like the craft. I like watching it. And I mean, a lot. There are things that are not for me, absolutely not for me. And I don't think they should be for anyone. And like, there are certain comedians now who say, oh, this cancel culture, they've cancelled me. I can't, theatre won't have me. I mean, it's not true. The reason they're not selling out theatres, they're not going in that theatre anymore, is because they're not selling tickets. That's the reason. They're not being cancelled. But their version of events is we're all woke and cancelling them. But it's not. It's just because they're not very good and outdated. And the stuff they're saying is so.
Yeah, yeah.
But there is also people, you know, there should be voice in stand up for everyone, left, right, to a certain extent. But then you can't take the freedom of speech thing and run with it. You have to draw a line somewhere.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, it comes at a cost, doesn't it, I suppose? And again, go on.
No, I was just going to say, I think that's where the intent thing comes in. If you make a joke about a subject, and the difference is obviously, we won't repeat the Jimmy Carr joke, but Jimmy Carr's made a joke recently in his show, which is one that's been pinpointed, has been picked out. It is a show called His Dark Materials, and it is his darkest jokes. That is the show. And I mean, there's nothing's not touched on. This certain joke. But a lot of people said the biggest problem with that joke is the reaction, where the crowd reaction should be, oh, which is fine, because that's what it should be. There's some cheering and whooping, which means a certain part of that audience have not taken the intent is that they're agreeing that's a good thing. And that is not the intention of the joke. So I think that's where there's a problem with, especially the older comedians who do your Roy Chubby Browns, your Jim Davison of the world.
Being offensive for the sake of being offensive,
And their audience are not going and seeing it ironically. They're going go, he's right there, they are doing this, or they have done this. So that's, again, that's a problem. You're not making a joke about the thing. You're making a joke for everyone to join in on.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it's the difference, isn't it, between being offensive, like you say, to egg on a crowd, and then doing satire. You know,
definitely.
Like, you're making fun of something, and you're making fun of the attitudes. You sound quite similar to me in that I prefer the latter.
absolutely. I am a fan of Frankie Boyle, because I think he is a great stand-up and a great writer. I don't agree with all of his jokes, which is the intention. You're not supposed to, because if you are agreeing with the jokes, you're kind of getting it wrong. That's not the intention.
Yeah.
But there are comedians, I just think, you're just doing offensive, because you're not even being clever about it. You're just being offensive.
Yeah.
I mean, there is an argument for it, no matter what, if you don't like the subject matter of the joke, if it's a good joke,
it's
still a good joke. Do you know what I mean? Sure. The structure of the joke is still good.
Yeah.
I don't like it, but...
Well, and as you said, you know, before, like, there has been a lot of thought and craft go into it, and I guess it's like a lot of things in life, right? If you decide it's not for you, that's fine. Just, you know, don't listen to it then.
like, I'm a big fan of horror as well. I love horror films, and well, I just love right. films, but
sure,
not all of them are for me. But of course, if there's yeah, certain films or even certain music, you can go, I'm not going to listen to that again, but I can respect it's why craft, people like it. Yeah, absolutely. The craft of it.
Completely agree. Yeah, yeah. And that, and that's kind of what we're about here as well with the show is celebrating these various things. And as you say, I feel like that's a really important point. I'm glad we've talked about it, this idea that for anyone who's listening and thinks, oh, I'm not sure I like stand-up, and to your point earlier, you know, oh, it's just people in a room saying jokes or whatever. It's like, no, they've put so much work into it. And to sort of backtrack a little bit, the idea that like one individual can get a stadium of people in the palm of their hands with comedy, I think is just incredible, right?
Oh, 100. It's an absolute art form. And there was a whole thing with when the lockdown, when we were in lockdown 1, 2, 3, or 4, whichever lockdown we were in, when the arts funds came in and stand-up wasn't part of the art fund. It wasn't. So, comedy clubs were not. Which, of anyone who is as a has an interest in stand-up comedy or comedy clubs would see as crazy. But again, I think that comes from snobbery.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Comes from snobbery as, well, it's not an art. It's just someone coming up, someone just standing up and telling jokes to people who are having a beer. But it's absolutely not. Like, there's a comedian now called Jordan Brooks who is doing amazing thing. I mean, it is really, it's challenging stuff. He does a show called Bleed, which I think is on YouTube now, which has to be watched with headphones on.
Right.
And when you were there in the audience, you had to have headphones on. And it becomes apparent why throughout the show. And it's an incredible piece of work. And to say that's not a piece of performance that has been honed within an inch of, like to the minute detail of a voice coming into a headphone. You know, that is the performance. I mean, maybe it does blur the line between theatre and stand-up, but you're the stand-up comedian. And the fact that it's not classed as an art is crazy.
No, absolutely. Because as you say, by definition, it's performance.
Yeah.
But yeah, it absolutely should be included in that. It just makes me wonder, actually, do you have any favourites then? You've named quite a few, but...
My favorite, like at the moment, like I said, there is through lockdown, there was a there's a comedy club called Always Be Comedy. But when the lockdown happened, they did Zoom gigs.
Oh, okay.
Which I was skeptical, but absolutely phenomenal, because obviously these comedians who couldn't go out and hone their craft in clubs still had shows to write. So they did it over Zoom. And I saw a few of my absolute favorite, Frankie Ball was one, but Ramesh Ranganathan is superb at the moment. John Robbins, don't know if you get a chance, John Robbins has got a special on Netflix. She's amazing. James A. Caster. I think there's a lot of really good comedians about at the moment.
Yeah.
Kiri Pritchard-McLean, who's a Welsh comedian. She's brilliant. Absolutely superb. And again, doing stuff is quite challenging and with a point to make. But
okay. So what is it then about these that makes them brilliant in your mind now? Like, what is it you look for in a stand-up?
I think sometimes with... So John Robbins, for instance, his show, the structure of it is so clever. And it doesn't have... Even doesn't always have to be about anything we can relate to. So, like, again, there's nothing wrong with Michael McIntyre and... Peter Kay and garlic bread. We've all had garlic bread. Fine. Funny. Like John Robbins did a show recently and he won the Perry Award. I'm not sure if it's the Perry Award now. It used to be the Perry Award. And it was about his breakup and dealing with mental health. And I mean, it's an intense show. So funny. But the structure throughout it builds to it. It's a story which builds to not only a punchline, but an end. It was brilliant. So John Robbins is one of my favourites because I think he is brilliant. Really clever.
I like that. And do you know what? I think that's something actually that is another credit to a lot of stand-ups. And I think it's becoming more and more the case these days, because to your point, I feel like the more straightforward, you could say, observational stuff, like you said, the McIntyres, the Kays, you know, Lee Evans to a degree, people like that, that they pick on the common ground stuff that's kind of surface level, and they're really good at it, and it's very entertaining. But I think a lot of comedians have sort of realized that there's more fertile material the more inward you go and the more personal you go. And that's another credit, right? Like, to go on a stage, do a show, as we've said, perform, and reveal a lot of stuff about yourself, you know?
Amazing.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. So just before the world went pandemic, I went to see Nick Helm in Cardiff, who is an really intriguing, like, interesting character anyway as a comedian. But his entire show was basically about him on antidepressants, which doesn't sound like the basis for a comedy show. It was hilarious, but also really, like, quite moving and stuff. And I took my me and my friends went, and afterwards we were saying, like, I mean, he was quite open about the effects that the antidepressants had on him and, you know, the depression had on him. And so we were then discussing that kind of thing. Mm. So it opened a conversation amongst a group of, group of men on having a beer in Cardiff. But then you left there talking about that. So I think, definitely, like, the comedians, I think it's always been a thing that comedy's always been political, but the stuff that gets on telly, again, it goes back to Michael McIntyre and to a certain extent, Live at the Apollo. If you're on the BBC, there's got to be you're appealing to a mass audience.
Yes.
But then there is Nish Kumar is doing some incredible political stuff. And then they cancelled The MASH Report, which was his show.
That's right,
I mean, he is doing, again, challenging people's beliefs. Stuart Lee, that's what he...
Yeah.
Stuart Lee does it. I mean, his shows are structured within an inch of their life, isn't it? Content provider is... There's not a word in any of his shows which is misplaced. Every word is honed. Again, it's a performance.
Yeah.
So, I think that is one thing, again, it gets forgotten that a lot of comedy, stand-up comedy shows and stand-ups are doing things which are about mental health. Important issues, politics and what's going on. So I think casting a net open and just looking at other comedians as well. I mean, again, it's not going to be for everyone.
Yeah.
But it's good to have your beliefs challenged sometimes as well.
Well, that's the thing. And I do think if somebody's making jokes about, you know, systems and your, like you said, your views on certain subjects, I don't think there's anything wrong with hearing them out. Even if you disagree, you've still heard them out. And to be fair, they're doing it for comedic effect. So you could just brush it off, you know, and not everyone has to agree with everybody, I think, you know. And again, like you said, that's kind of the point of a lot of these shows is I think the more skillful comedians go in with the angle of like, look, I'm not trying to tell you to think the same way as me. I'm just saying, think about it. And they just leave it. You know, the ones that do, I think, get a bit too much and sort of start ramming it down your throat a bit. I agree. You know, because we all know who they are, the ones that kind of bang the same drums over and over. But again, that's their thing. And if that's how they feel and it's their mic, it's their show. If you don't like it, Don't hang around. That's okay.
Yeah, exactly. And we all know who they are. They've been doing it for 30, 40 years now, and they're still doing the same material. Just now they're blaming woke culture for them not selling out arenas or not getting on telly. But the fact is, they're just not very good anymore.
Yeah.
And people have grown out of that humor. There's a different audience for it now, and there is the audience who've been going for them for years, but I think I don't think you'll find that they have a new audience. I think they've got the same audience to follow, and the reason they're not selling out the arenas or selling out these things now is because the older their audience are, the less there is. They're not growing any numbers.
No, exactly.
At all. Yeah. So this is why, again, Nish Kumar is selling out like big venues because, and he is political. That's what he does. And he,
yeah.
But he's selling out because there's a new audience, people who are a bit more. Like, again, I'm not taking away from what people believe or any, but I think we're more, because of, we're more educated in bigger things, bigger issues, and sure. Comedians are not afraid to tackle them now.
Yeah, yeah. And again, that's kind of the point of comedy, I suppose, is in a way, isn't it? I heard something the other day, actually, I thought was quite profound. It came up after the whole Oscars incident,
right,
and there's a lot of like, which is already, funny enough, has already been discussed on this show, to peel back the curtain a little bit. There is a Fresh Prince episode that will be out before.
Okay.
Recorded 4 days after that happened. I was like, okay. But the reason why I'm bringing it up again is because I was just curious about people's reaction, and because that involved comedy and jokes, you know, naturally there are people on different sides of it. And something that came up in a review and I thought was really interesting was a clip of Joan Rivers. Now, Joan Rivers isn't somebody I know a lot about in her comedy. I've not listened to a lot of it. But she's known for being a bit edgy and making jokes that,
yeah,
as you said, make people feel uncomfortable. That was part of her career. But she's dealing with a heckler. And she puts it, obviously I can't remember it quote word for word, but in an essence, what she was saying was like, I've had struggles too. She was like, she pointed out to this person like, I grew up with a mum who was deaf. I'm going to make jokes about it. I had a husband for a while who had one leg, who was disabled after being in war. I'm making jokes about it. It's like, do you know why? Because it helps me cope. And that's part of comedy is, and I was thinking about it afterwards, and I was like, she's got a point, actually. Like, we all make jokes sometimes at the darkest moments. I mean, gallows humor, right? It exists for a reason, you know? And so I think some of these comedians, like you said, who are going up and they're making jokes about depression or mental health or whatever it is, they're not doing it because they want to be offensive and hurt people's feelings. They're doing it because it's a way of coping. And sometimes the best way to get through something that's difficult is to find the funny side.
Absolutely. And I mean, it is, as you said, gallows humour. And there's nobody you know that doesn't have that self-deprecation or that coping mechanism of making a joke about things.
Right.
I mean, it's what we do.
Yeah, so, especially if you're British. We're really good at it.
Absolutely. And yeah, we are. And we do that, whether it's with your friends, with in work. It is what we do. So, yeah, I mean, it's a coping mechanism. And some people want to tell everyone about it on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And again, going back to that Nick Helms show, is like he is bringing something which is not, it's not funny. Like it's wrong to say there's nothing funny about depression because he's done a show about it, which was very funny. Mm. But it's also highlighted something and opening the conversation.
Yeah, yeah. And that's right. And that's the other side of it, isn't it? Is you learn to laugh at yourself, laugh at these situations, you cope, and then you go away and think about it afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if that's the case, I think job done. That's incredible if you can do that. Yeah, it's just it's interesting to me, the people that usually get quite defensive, you know, and say, you can't make jokes about that. And I'm like, well, maybe you can't. Maybe you find it too touchy, and fair enough if that's the case. But clearly they don't. And you know, like you said, the assumption that the comedian is punching down, it's often like, well, do you know where they're coming from? And more often than not, a lot of them, as we've established, are coming from a very personal experience or a very dark place, and it's their way of just kind of dealing with it.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a history of with comedy. I mean, it's the old cliche, the tears of a clown thing, but there is a history of you know, the dark side of people, and for I would imagine for a lot of comedians, if you do have a depression, or Frank Skinner talks a lot about his alcoholism, as is Frankie Boyle.
Right.
He's a recovering alcoholic. And it's almost, it's a release because you can talk about it.
Yeah.
It's the same. Hannah Gadsby showed us it. Yeah, Hannah Gadsby, I think there's another subjects at the time. So the Me Too movement gets covered a lot in comedy at the moment. Right.
Yeah.
But it is, of course, there's some of that's offensive, the way it's dealt with, but it is opening that conversation, which I think is the point.
Yeah.
You have to talk about these dark things because they're there.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the fascinating thing about it, right? About all of this is that, as you say, there's a lot of work goes into it. It's a performance piece, but it's also often tackling big subjects and getting you to think about things, you know, and that's amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, it is highlighting things maybe that you don't think about as much. Like, you wouldn't necessarily maybe go to a comedy show and then the subject is mental health. It's not something you'd expect, but then you're there and you're thinking about it. Stuart Lee is very political. He obviously where he sits on the political spectrum, and he makes that obvious. But he just, it's a chance again. I would imagine his audience is his total audience and not that way politically. I would imagine quite a lot of them are. But again, it's opening that chat and thinking about things you may not think about or looking from a different point of view. So someone who goes on stage, who is Mr. Super Confident, you've seen them on the telly, you've seen them singing songs, and then goes on stage and they talk about having massive mental health issues or depression, or you then can sit there yourself and go, see, it's not anyone can be depressed or...
Yeah,
so it's I think sometimes stand-up is pigeonholed in that someone goes up and makes jokes and that's it. But it's not. It's definitely an art.
It is an art. And like you said, there's so many different ways people have done it. I mean, we keep mentioning Stuart Lee. He's somebody that I think is incredible at what he does because he does it in a very unique fashion. The ability, I think, to take a joke like he does and stretch it out for 20 minutes. And it goes through that cycle of being funny, not funny, funny, not funny. And he always seems to know exactly where to end it. And it's brilliant. And I'll say to this day, he has ruined Top Gear for me. If anyone knows. Just look up Stuart Lee Top Gear, and after 15 minutes, you will never be able to watch that program again.
I saw Stuart Lee. There's a comedy festival in Macunthlaith in Wales, which is it's an incredible, incredible festival. It's actually next weekend. We used to go every year, but unfortunately, I can't this year. And what they do is they utilize the entire village. So there's two pubs and they do performances in the school gym, in the churches, and it's all people. That's where I saw Stuart Lee. They go and they're honing their craft. It's all talk reviews and things.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. And I saw Stuart Lee there, and it was during Brexit. Stuart Lee's opening line. Stuart Lee's opening line, I will not repeat, but it definitely could have. It definitely divided an audience if they weren't expecting to go and see Stuart Lee.
Right.
Regarding Brexit. But it's that kind of thing. During things like the Brexit now and, Brexit, and we've got the pandemic now, comedy is one of those things, again, that it definitely highlights it and gets different points of view, because there will be a lot of stand-up now about the pandemic and how it was dealt with. And the Tory government, how they dealt with it. So there's going to be a new... It's always highlighting what's happening. And again, we use the same phrase again, but open the conversation about it, whether you like it or not.
And as you say, with someone like that, it's kind of what he does.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean,
that's his thing. It's challenging.
Yeah.
But, you know, and in terms of his structure, I just find him amazing. That ability, I said, to just drag something out for so long But to have something to say as well, like he's not just repeating himself and mumbling on for like 20 minutes. It's new ideas on the same thing over and over and over, and then it just lands on a joke. And it's an incredible tightrope, isn't it, to walk? You just
think, absolutely. He is a master of you. Even in one joke, you're not really sure where it's going, and it changes direction a few times, and you're still caught off guard thinking, "Where's he going?" And then the repeat comes in. You're like, what? But again, like you say, that's not by accident. That craft of knowing where to land that punchline at the right time, when it comes to the point where you could be, "I've lost interest in this now. This is." But bang, his again, uniquely delivered. I can't think of anyone even close to like a similar delivery and similar style. I mean, I'm sure there's people who emulate it now because he's always the comedian's comedian. He's always a top list of because he is amazing. But I think that's another thing. It's quite interesting. Sorry, it's quite interesting if you listen to other comedians talk about comedians, and that's where I found a lot of comedians. Because I listened to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast where he interviews comedians, and there's Stuart Goldsmith does one as well. They talk about comedians that I may not have heard of. So I go and listen to those because they're people from the industry talking about, best check them out. So I think that's probably why Stuart Lee is other comedians' favourite comedian, because he's so structured and so good.
Yeah. I even remember a show, I think it was one where he addresses the whole like being in the list. And I think the title was like 43rd best comedian or something like that. And it's so funny. And like the whole thing just hangs on this recurring joke where like he tells a story about his mum complaining about his comedy and saying, "Why can't you be like this comedian I saw on a boat one time?" And then he goes into a whole tirade about this comedian and his backstory and how like he was a disgraced person and does this whole thing for like an hour. And then obviously the joke ends where it's like his mum goes, "Oh no, that wasn't his name. It was someone else." But he was really funny, Stuart. And I'm just paraphrasing it, but it's one of those, you watch it and you go, I cannot believe you've just done an entire show on a bad joke. Like you've just led us on this massive journey for no reason. And it ends on this really silly punchline.
But it's
very clever, and again, it's that workshopping. You can imagine he spent hours trying to figure out, like, how long do I do this bit for this bit of the story? How far can I take it? You know, and just it's genius. It's really clever.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, that structure doesn't come. And that punchline, like he must have known in the back of you going. So that build-up has to be incredible for that punchline to work, because that's another thing. The punchline doesn't always have to be an amazing punchline. I mean, it helps. Mm. But if you've gone on that journey to get there, and then you can always, he always plays on the fact that it's a bad punchline. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant way of doing it. Yeah, there's nothing like you get like Stuart Lee is, like you say, those elongated, long, drawn-out builds to something. But there's absolutely... There's definitely a skill to people who can reel off one-liners for an hour and a half. I mean...
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's the opposite end, right? And
Yeah,
I think of people like one of my absolute favourites, Tim Vine.
A
lot of his jokes are so simple and so... But they're just brilliant. And it's like, how do you remember all of those? How do you store like 200, 300 jokes and just reel them off? it's just incredible.
It's with Tim Vine and I can't remember, Milton Jones is another one. Even if he didn't like that one, there's another one coming up. You haven't even got time to go, "Oh, that was terrible," because you're already slapping the face. And I'm sure that is part of his way of doing it. That structure is that's how he does it, because he can go fire him out. And if one doesn't land, there's another one on the way that will. Like remembering those jokes and writing, like Jimmy Carr wrote a book called The Naked Jim, and he says that he'll sit down no matter what every day and write 5 jokes in the morning.
Wow,
that's what he does. He'll write 5. 4 of them will be terrible, but to keep going, he writes 5 jokes every morning. And I suppose it's the same as anyone. It's just flexing the muscle, isn't it? I guess, where you just got to keep your brain ticking over.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, right? Like, as you say, it's it's not only the ability to sort of house all of that and perform it, it's coming up with them, you know. And I think that makes sense actually, to do something like that, to wake up and go, right, I've got to write something just to keep your sort of your brain going. And then you just must have a massive list of them that you can just go through and then workshop. And then you end up with like a 2-hour show where you're just reeling off all of these jokes, you know.
So I wouldn't know off, like, I would know, but I would, Tim Vine, an hour show, I don't know how many jokes it must be.
Oh, goodness. But, yeah.
You know, you're talking 1 a minute easy with Tim Vine, because they're all one-liners. From, again, it's frowned upon a little bit with, like, prop comedy and things is a frowned upon, but there is someone out there, and if they're laughing, then they're doing their job.
Right. Well, I mean, to kind of come back to what we said earlier, it's the same with music, right? It's not going to appeal to everybody. Not everyone's going to like the same thing. Comedy is the same. Yeah, whether you like the long, drawn-out stuff, or if you like the quick one-liners, or maybe a bit of both, or you might be something entirely different. Like you said, prop comedy, you might like sketch, you might like all sorts of different stuff. But there's so much available. So yeah, I mean, think, if you don't like it, it's fine. Just go look somewhere else.
Yeah, because my first proper comedy gig I remember going to see was League of Gentlemen. I went to see League of Gentlemen live on this.
Wow, okay.
In Cardiff. And, yeah, I mean, again, it's sketch comedy, so it probably wouldn't be for everyone. But it was absolutely incredible. They got heckled, and they dealt with it in character, which is even different again. But it was amazing. And, that was my first gig. First, when I went to without my parents, me and my friend went to see League of Gentlemen on the train. And, amazing. But again, that's a sketch comedy. It's not my favourite thing. I'm not a massive, an on-stage sketch comedy. I mean, there are some brilliant ones around. League of Gentlemen was they're like the gold standard, I suppose, because they are amazing. But again, those sketches have got to be so finely tuned and come to something for that to work, because it's hard enough to do it on telly when you're watching it from your living room to go, you know, I didn't want that, a fan of that sketch. But then to have that as a live audience, that's it's bold, because it
very,
as you know, sketches can be really hit and miss.
Yeah.
Like even the best sketch shows on telly, I mean, they're not always for me, because the sketches don't land. So to do that on stage, the League of Gentlemen, they did the first half in just dinner suits.
Right. Okay.
But did the voices of these sketches. They did one where they taped their noses up. But then the second half, they came out completely in character, and it was amazing then, because if you like League of Gentlemen. But yeah, to do that as well, to just have dinner suits on. And it was in an arena, so it was a big gig, just dinner suits and just did the voices, but you were in. And it's an amazing talent.
It totally is. And again, it like you say, it's a whole other art form. And that's kind of the other thing I think is really cool about stand-up and comedy in general, live performance comedy, is there's so much variation now. As you say, it used to be, I think you would have thought, oh yeah, it's a guy doing one line. It's like, well, that's one.
Yeah,
you can have sketch, you can have observational. And then within those, like you said, you can then go, well, you get your more political ones. You can get people that deal with, you know, the more mental health, or they deal with, you know, all sorts of different topics. I think of people, some of my absolute favorites, people like I guess Eddie Izzard, Dylan Moran, you know, people that are like kind of a bit out there. Their kind of comedy is a bit just random seemingly, and they'll pick on history and they'll pick on all sorts of different things that has nothing to do with present day living, but it's still incredible and it's still really funny. You know,
Eddie Izzard especially, I mean, well, Dylan Moran is brilliant as well, but Eddie Izzard, that almost almost stream of consciousness comedy, where it just seems like it's just coming out and it's improvising that. But I don't know for sure, but I'm sure with Eddie Izzard, that structure is there, and that's how we believe, we perceive it, is it? This stream of consciousness. But again, it must be finely tuned to a point, because
I think so,
you have to have a show. So, they, like, they, the DVD. I remember having the DVDs of the VHS of Glorious Diazad, and it's an amazing show. I think it was called Glorious. But yeah, and even watching it, it seems improvised. But
yeah,
that show would not be structured. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
There's those wild flights of flights of fancy and things are there to get to a point, the punchline of
And again, I was going to say that's a skill in itself. You know, I think I talked about Dylan Moran a while back on a few episodes because we talked about Black Books, and like I remember watching him in a theater in Bristol, and it felt like you say stream of consciousness. I described it as like comedy jazz, like it's kind of just going all over the place, but it has a rhythm and it has something going on, and you're like, I don't know what this is, but it's kind of brilliant. And that you say it is going to a point. And there is something hidden in there that you think, oh, that's so random and strange, your choice of words there. But you've just made me think actually about something. And like, you think, how do you do that? Again, that's another skill in itself, right? Is being able to write and craft something like that.
Yeah, that random choice of words.
Yeah.
That's even a word can change a joke from being funny to not that just a choice of word. You even see that in... like when you watch films and they do at the end they show the line readings.
Yes.
There's a reason they've chosen that line, which seemingly would be like, but it's worked. So that's why I would like Dylan Moran and would even a word can change that laugh.
Yeah, and I think it's a skill as well to be able to pick those words, you know, because you try and do it yourself. And you think, oh, no. And you can spend ages. Like, I would encourage people listening now just to try and think of it. Try and think of like a funny anecdote and changing some of the language. You could be stuck for like 5 or 10 minutes going, oh, was that funny? Or was that too weird? And these guys just reel it off like it's nothing. And it's incredible. Absolutely amazing. And again, that's just another style of comedy you could just go and check out.
Yeah, there's a... not all of it's for me. Like surreal comedy is not always for me. Like you think of even Vic and Bob, that's how they started. They were stand-ups. They were doing stand-up shows. And now National Treasure, Bob Mortimer. But like, if you watch like his Big Night Out and Vic Rees and Bob Mortimer's Big Night Out, or it's nuts. There is no, if I or anyone else maybe said, this is what we're going to do in front of an audience. It may not be fun, but for some reason, they've got that thing where they can do that, which is just essentially sometimes hitting Vic Reeves in the face with a big pan.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But it's really funny when they do it. There's something about it. They've got something about it. Them in particular can do that. Whether it's because no one else was doing it, and they are unique. And that's another thing. Like, there are voices that are really unique in comedy, which... in the hands of other people just wouldn't come across. But yeah, so I think there's a lot of voices in stand-up. There's something for everyone when it comes to stand-up.
Exactly. This is the thing I think is really cool. I mean, I'm just glancing up. I've got a few DVDs squirreled away somewhere here, and you know, another one that comes to my mind, someone who I think does another side of comedy really well, Dara Brian. And I've seen him do it in front of my eyes, the ability to pick on people in the crowd at random and just draw stories out of them and then tie it into the show. And it's just like, how do you do that? I don't know how you could just pick something out. And, you know, he must be sweating bricks every time he picks on someone, thinking like, please have an interesting job or something. And like, see how fast their cogs are turning just to try and be like, okay, how much kind of material can I get out of you before I can move on? And can I tie it in? And, you know, sometimes it works beautifully, and other times you must think there must just be nothing. You know, if you pick on the one person that has nothing to say.
You know? But then there's also that again, the intelligence that comes with the stand-up comedian who are at the top of their game, because that to have all that information locked away, ready to just whatever the subject is, to just, you know, to have that, whether it be something simple, but you've such a backlog of stuff to say and be able to talk on a subject. You it's no accident that a lot of stand-up comedians become authors or become writers, or because they have a they would have to have a huge knowledge on subjects for that reason. Yeah. If you're going to challenge people, then you expect to be challenged back. So you need to, and they must do.
Yeah, they must do, absolutely. And I guess that kind of comes back as well to dealing with the hecklers, isn't it? You've got to have a few locked away of like, how do I deal with this? And
yeah,
that knowledge and the jokes, you've just got to have so much. You've got to have so much prepared, I think. And I'd imagine it's like a lot of things. You'll just get better as you go along. But it's a dedication, right? It's certainly something. Oh. I think the standing out of this conversation is so much work that goes into it. And,
100%. I mean, there was a mentioned again, but Frankie Boyle wrote a piece, and again, out of context, it seemed that he was saying that Ricky Gervais is not a stand-up comedian, and there is an argument that he's not. He's a very good writer, performs his material, and right. Frankie Boyle's argument, well, I think it was Frankie Boyle, his argument was that Ricky Gervais has never had to work his way through the clubs. He's walked into an arena with an already a fan base of What's the Office. Right. So he's saying he's a brilliant writer, but not necessarily a stand-up. He's a writer and performer. Whereas Frankie Boyle and James Acaster, Ed Gamble, they've all had to do those, maybe a working men's club that is absolutely not James Acaster's audience.
Right.
But he's gone out there and done it, and he may have bombed, but they've had to work their way up to it.
Mm.
Like, is it? Yeah. So, James Acaster is an incredible comedian.
Yeah, do you know what? He's someone I love. And yeah, again, for people listening, go and check out. He's done a ton of interviews and different podcasts. Actually, a friend of the show, Mark Woodjatt, interviewed him on Mark and Me a while ago. Really interesting conversation. He talks a lot about that, about those experiences of moments where he felt like, what am I doing? I just want to quit. Because even though he liked writing jokes, and it's clear he enjoys performing it and gets a kick out of it. Like you said, he's someone who definitely has a bit of a niche. Like, he's a bit more of your surreal, I think he edges on that kind of side of it.
Definitely,
like you said, a working man's club at 1 a.m. Probably not his audience, you know.
Not gonna be his vibe. But he's a unique voice, and his delivery and his he is a newly unique voice. And I would imagine he's got an audience, a fan base now who know what they're going in for.
Yeah.
But to stand up and do that to an audience who don't know what they're in for must be terrifying.
Oh, yeah. He has a really funny story. Again, I think it was Off Menu. He brought it up where, like, he was at some club and some guy was just really giving him an awful time in the audience the whole time. And in the end, he just snapped. He just went, all right, mate, here you go. Go on. Have the mic up, you get. And the guy was initially kind of like, oh, yeah, I'll do this. Probably had a few too many beers thinking he could do it. And he said, I watched him and he went up there. I took his seat. I sat there. And after like 2 minutes, he started bombing. And he had this panic look in his eyes. And he was trying to give me the mic back. And I was going, no, it's your set. It's your set. You wanted this. And it's funny because he was talking about it. He's like, I probably shouldn't have done that. If I was listening to it going, nah, fair play. Like, fair play. Just,
yeah.
Yeah. If anyone ever thinks about doing that, they probably think twice if they hear that story. Okay, you do it then. Oh, actually, no.
Yeah, maybe not.
Maybe not. No, sorry, I'll shut up.
I saw James Acaster at twice in that comedy festival I said about. And the one show I saw was at 10 o'clock in the morning, and it was James Acaster doing stand up for kids.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, a unique voice, but could do something different. And he did a show, a stand-up show for kids, where the premise was he was going to write a book when he wanted to make, as in his words, loads of sweet dollar off the kids, because the kids would shout out stuff. They would come and act it on stage, and he would just do his thing. That's and it was adorable. Phenomenal. Yeah, it was phenomenal. In fact, I've got 4 children, and my 2 8-year-old daughters, they were about 4 at the time, sat next to me, and he was saying, I need you to call out an animal. And my daughter's going, I'm going to die. I said, you've got to you've got to show it. With that, she got up and started walking down, but took her sister with her, and they slowly walked down the middle of the aisle towards James Acaster. Now, my daughters, they were dressed the same. They had run, and the show stopped. Yeah, and James Acaster went, "This is the most terrifying thing I've ever seen. I'm being approached by the Grady twins." So, yeah, so they became part of the show. Oh. And then they just walked up the stage and they both went crocodile and walked off. And he weirdly mentioned it on something a couple of weeks after on an interview. And he mentioned that story and said that, yeah, he said that he amazing. Got the Shining twins came up to him and said about being about crocodile. That was my daughter's. But yeah, so that even doing that kind of thing is another craft. It just shows the level of craft they got in there, where you can do a show for kids even. And I've seen a few comedians do that kind of thing.
Mm.
And it was still a James Acaster show. You know, it's still James Acaster doing his thing, but just playing it down for kids. And it was incredible.
That, again, that is a remarkable skill set to do that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. To be able to, on a dime, know your audience and adjust like that. Oh man, I wish I could have seen that. That sounds amazing. I bet your kids loved it as well.
They did love it. Yeah, it gets brought up quite a lot. When James Acaster is on telly, well, it's the one you said crocodile to.
Yeah, and like you say, and he's somebody who now has the Netflix specials, right? And that feels like a whole other field now, where you've got comedians, you know, as we said, it used to be live at the Apollo was the big gig and panel shows and stuff. And now that streaming's around, you've got people doing YouTube shows, Netflix, Amazon Prime. Yeah. You know, I imagine it won't be long before sort of Disney and others start bringing in.
I think so. And I think,
you know,
they appear on Amazon and things again, like the, going back to Always Be Comedy, which is a comedy club, and these online shows, they still do them. And I regularly watch, log into them, and they are superb. Again, it does open up stand-up because, as I say, I've got four kids. I don't get to go and see stand-up as much as I used to.
Yeah.
But now the kids go to bed and I can log in to a gig, essentially, and watch it.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, what they do is incredible. James Acaster has done it regularly, and there'll be James Acaster sat in his front room doing a gig, and it's amazing. But again, it's opening it up to an even bigger audience.
Yeah, I can't believe I didn't know about this during lockdowns. You mentioned it earlier. I just had a little look now.
Mm.
Yeah, they've got stuff now, like for the next couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah, and absolutely. So and what they'll do is it is interactive as well. So what they do is they send an email out with the Zoom link and maybe 200 people. They have what's called a front row. So if you message us, and basically they'll just have 12 people on the front row. And because we were regulars, I mean, we were doing twice a week. We used to watch them during lockdown. We'd be on the front row. So we chatted to Ramesh Ranganathan and things. And it was incredible. It was an amazing thing. But yeah, they're still doing it. And sometimes they'll do interactive shows in where it's just, like I say, James Acaster's front room. But what they also do now is they stream from the comedy club. So you're watching the gig at home, essentially, which is great because I can't get to London because I don't live in London. Do you know what I mean? And it does, it brings access to everyone then.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just having a little scroll through and a bunch of the people we've named have been on there. Another one that jumps out to me, someone I'm a big fan of because of his podcasting work, Mike Wozniak, I think is incredible. And I just
so good.
A few times.
Yeah, so good.
Yeah. So again, as like you said, there's access and a lot of them I could see on there. And you just mentioned, you know, they're performing in these clubs, but you're basically like paying for a streaming ticket, which.
Yeah. And I mean,
brilliant. Absolutely. What they go for it.
Yeah, 100%. Because if you book a night where there's four comedians on, and you only know two of them, or even one of them, it's £5. You know, and you're going to see, you're going to see three comedians. You may think may become your favorite comedian ever, and also three different voices. You know, so
totally. And again, it's you just try it out, and if you decide one's not for you, give it half hour or whatever. Then
that's it.
Someone else will be on. Yeah. That's awesome, man. And I mean, you're quite fortunate where you are. So you've said you've got a few clubs near you. Is that right? The Glee Club, I do recognise that one.
Yeah, I used to. Well, I used to live in Cardiff. I live in Worcester now, but in Cardiff, okay. The Glee Club, we used to go to quite a lot because it was 20 minutes up the road.
Right.
I mean, there's one in Birmingham, like I say, with
kids.
The four kids at the minute. A few and far between. But this is why that always be comedy has been great, because we've essentially had a comedy night at home. But yeah, but there is something special about going to a comedy club.
Yeah, totally, man.
An atmosphere. And if you get any comedy club you get to go to, I went to Edinburgh a couple of weeks ago and I saw Lou Sanders at the Strand, and it was amazing just to be in a room again and that.
Yeah.
A good laugh unifies everyone. You kind of like forget about everything because you're just, everyone loves a laugh. Or even to the point sometimes, there's nothing wrong with someone saying someone's shocking because you're all unified in the shock of it. And it's a nice, also it's a bit different. And if you go and see someone you don't really know, there's that danger you're not going to like them. So it is exciting in itself.
Right. Yeah, I could see that. And I definitely think live performance is something I love. I mean, I lean quite heavily on the music side, but whenever I have been in comedy shows, the atmosphere is always great.
Yeah.
So everyone's there just to have a good time. And the really funny thing about it is, I think as well, like being in a live show versus, you know, watching a DVD or something on YouTube, is you can memorize the stuff at home. You know, you'll hear the sketch and you'll laugh. Yeah. And for some reason, when you're at home watching it, you'll just kind of, something will stick out and you'll just, you know, like going back to what we were saying earlier, when you're at school, you know, I can recite this to my mates and it's there. And then you go and watch someone in a room and it's just even funnier for some reason. I don't know what it is about just being in the room and you just forget everything. I've seen a bunch of comedians and I don't know about you, I can never remember anything. I just walk out of the gig and they go, oh, what was one of the jokes? No idea. Couldn't tell you. I was just laughing hysterically for an hour.
I think it's, exactly. It's the atmosphere. You're dragged along with the whole atmosphere of everyone else as well. It's the same with, like, I've seen like comedy films in the cinema, which I thought were hilarious in an audience with everyone else laughing. Watch them again at home. I thought, wasn't that funny? It was all right.
Yeah, it was all right.
I think it's that, you know, that atmosphere with an audience makes something even better.
Definitely. And it must be really nice for them up on the stage as well, when you can feel that coming back to you.
Oh, yeah, I would imagine. So, I mean, I would imagine a comedian would feed off that. And I've seen it before, and I think, you know, when you watch panel shows, for instance, you can almost see the eyes light up and go, I'm going to go with this a bit further, because the audience are rolling with it.
Yeah.
I mean, Sean Locke was incredible at that. Like, Eight or 10 Cats. Watching him making other comedians laugh, you could see that was his spark and he would just go. And he was amazing anyway. But, like, that feeding off the audience and that atmosphere and that vibe coming from them must be incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Such a loss, that one right there. That was last year, wasn't it?
I think this year, wasn't that?
Was it this year?
Not long ago at all. And so because he was a comic mind. It's so sharp. You watch him. Lee Mack is another one on. Who is so sharp.
Yeah.
So quick. And he's another clever one who can do a joke that, it's not even sometimes, it's real quick. It's not even essentially that great, a line. But he almost does a wink as if to say, I know, but I got it before you did. That kind of thing, do you know what I mean? Which is so sharp. But Sean Locke was amazing.
Yeah, he was. And that's the thing, we're really fortunate, I think, in this country in particular, with so much amazing talent in comedy. And like you said, I think panel shows are often a good chance as well to see people, you know, having a go. And sometimes, especially again, I remember watching, you know, all the live at Apollo, and used to watch, you know, Wheat, Buzzcocks, Will I Lie to You, as you mentioned. And then you see guests pop up and you go, oh, okay. And then you go away and look them up on YouTube or whatever. And that could be another way of discovering people.
It's good. I mean, it's still the balance of men to women is still an issue with a lot of panel shows, I think, and it's brought up a lot in comedy, but it is getting better. And there is a wider range of people appearing on things. I think it is a shame we haven't got a really good stand-up show anymore. That it essentially, right. I think Jonathan Ross tried it last year where he had like a 6-part stand-up show where he had new stand-ups on, new to TV. Yeah. And I don't think there was an audience for it, which is strange because I think the problem is with Live at the Apollo sometimes, they're established comedians.
Yeah, it felt like there was a window, wasn't there, where it was kind of, it felt fresh. Yeah, it did feel like there was a period in time where Live at the Apollo was bringing out a lot of fresh talent. Actually, one of the names you mentioned earlier, Michael McIntyre, there was a time when he was like a new guy on the block, you know, and then some of these other guys, I think, like Russell Howard, Dara Brian, the list goes on, you know. Whereas, like you say, within less than 10 years, they all became like huge, big established names. But then, like you said, but then they kept coming back to it and it kind of washed out the chance for anybody else up and coming to have a go. And like you say, it kind of becomes a bit of a, who's really famous and popular at the minute? Who can we get on so that people will watch it rather than who's new in the talent circuit? Who's, you know, interesting? Who can we put out there? And it feels like their gateway now is through like panel shows and having to try and work the circuits, the clubs. And then if they can get on to, you know, Taskmaster or Buzzcocks or any of the other shows, they might have a chance, you know, to go a little bit further.
Yeah, Taskmaster is one I think does quite good at that because they have the benefit of 5. So you can have a Frank Skinner or Ardal Hanlon now, and then have someone like, Sophie Duker is brilliant, but maybe she's not as well known only because I've seen it on That Always Be Comedy and things. But you have the opportunity to have someone like Sophie Duker, who is fairly new and up and coming. You're introduced to her that way. But I don't. It's a shame there's not a stand up show, or there's not. There's obviously not an audience for it for some reason. Where you're introducing like new challenge, like as I mentioned earlier, Jordan Brooks. Who is incredibly challenging, like absolutely brilliant. And as far as unique voices go, he is incredibly unique. But maybe it doesn't work in a 15 minutes on Live. He absolutely wouldn't do Live at the Apollo, but that definitely wouldn't work. But I mean, to have a stand-up show where you are having those new talents or new different voices.
It would be good. I know the Edinburgh Fringe Festival here is very popular, and I remember the BBC used to cover that, and there was there was one particular night where they did a big show, and the whole thing was televised, and they gave a lot of comedians like little 10-minute sets. And I remember watching that one year and thinking like, oh, that's really cool, and you heard lots of different people's voices, but I haven't seen it around for a while. Again, I don't know if they bother investing the time to film it anymore.
Saying that, I think I do remember. I think it was it may have been BBC Three. Live at the Fringe or something along those lines. But I don't know.
Well, it sounds like, you know, if people are listening, they think maybe I'll get into it a bit more and try it. You've got some good places to go. I mean, like you said, Always Be Comedy's got stuff there. Yeah. You can find stuff on YouTube or Netflix and Prime. You can just have a flick around, right? And
there is actually a streaming site called Next Up Comedy, which is basically Netflix for stand-up. Is always worth a look. I mean, they do the usual, you know, your free trial, but it's a subscription service. But they've got a massive range of established and new comedy, and they do the same thing. They do live gigs, so live stream gigs, and that's an incredible thing to. Even if you cherry pick and have a look at stuff, again, you don't have to like everything. Not all of it's for me. But it's worth looking at these things to see.
Yeah, this is awesome. I've just quickly pulled it up. I'm going to put this in the show notes for everybody because all of these things I think are well worth looking at. And like you say, there's a good mix here of established and sort of new people. There's a few names I know and there's a few I don't.
Yeah,
cool. Yeah, there you go. You've got another opportunity to check out some more stuff there. I love it. Awesome. That's what it's all about, right? It's discovery and hearing new voices.
Yeah, hearing new voices and again, it challenges this things that subjects that may not be something you want to hear or are particularly interested in, maybe, but it's always worth hearing people's viewpoints. And if you can do that in a way that's funny as well,
yeah,
it's a win-win.
Too right. Well, I just want to say, thanks for walking us through all of this, Will. And was there anything else you wanted to bring up? Because I feel like this feels like a bit of a natural winding down period, but is there anything else you really wanted to bring up with stand-up?
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered everything. I've told my James A. Castor Shining Twin story, so that's something. Yeah.
No. I love that. That's great.
Yeah.
Might see if I can make that a clip and tag him in it and see if he'll respond, but
yeah,
never know. But still, I mean, that's your daughter's claim to fame right there.
That is, yeah, they scared James Acaster.
I love it. Well, on that note, yeah, thank you for coming on, Will. And I guess now's a chance to plug stuff. You know, where can the good people find you? Is there anything you wanted to mention or shout out?
I've just started on Twitter at Will Chich. That's pretty much where I'm at. Nothing to plug.
Okay. No, that's totally
I will plug Always Be Comedy because they are brilliant. So, yeah.
I think that's really fair. And again, I'll put links to all of that in the show notes. People can go and have a look. All that's left to say is thanks for coming on, Will.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
And there we have it. A huge thank you to Will for coming onto the podcast and sharing your love of all things stand-up comedy with me. I hope you guys enjoyed that episode as much as I did. Make sure you go and give Will a follow if you're on Twitter. I've linked his details in the show notes, as well as a coffee page that he has where you can go and give him a bit of support. You want to say thanks to him for being on this and other podcasts. Also linked in the show notes are the two websites that we talked about, Always Be Comedy and Next Up Comedy. Both of those could be found there, and they're ways of supporting up-and-coming stand-up comedians, as well as comedians warming up, as we discussed, doing their material, workshopping it, all of that good stuff. You can find it on those websites. It's an excellent way of supporting people who are getting out there and making their comedy dreams come true. Speaking of supporting artists, if you like what you see with the logo of this very podcast, it was designed by Alex. His details are in the show notes as well. So if you fancy getting yourself some graphic design work done, you can do that. I'm also told he's published a child's book, which is available via his website as well. So there's another guy you can go and support. Again, links are in the description of this very podcast episode. And continuing that theme of support, you can support this very podcast. There are a few simple ways to do it. The best way is honestly just to tell people. It really does make a massive difference to independent podcasters such as myself. If you like the episode, you like the show, just word of mouth really goes a long way. You can also tell people via social media. If you're on Twitter or Instagram, make sure you give me a follow via the details provided in the show notes and tag me in the comments so I can say thank you. You can also leave me a lovely 5-star review on your favorite podcatcher. If you do that, then please make sure you tell me again via the social media details or even email. You can send me an email. That's also in the show notes. I would love to say thank you for giving me a lovely 5-star review or rating. It really is the least that I can do. Also, if you want to go and give me some financial support, then there is a TeePublic store for the podcast that is linked in the show notes with an affiliate link. So if you fancy getting the wonderful logo put on a t-shirt, on a mug, on a laptop cover, the list goes on, then by all means, have a look. Make sure you grab something for yourself and let me know that you have, because again, I would love to thank you on the podcast and via the social media channels for supporting this very show. Right, that's enough from me. I'll be back again in a few weeks' time with a completely different guest on a completely different subject. So make sure that you're subscribed, you're followed, all that good stuff so you don't miss out. And I will see you next time.